The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, I'm Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, and this week the show is skin deep as we delve into the intricacies of an organ that profoundly affects human psychology.
For several years, I was finding it difficult to explain to people that I was doing my PhD on the hair follicle because they weren't quite sure whether I was actually going to become a hairdresser as a result of it or not. So it was a very unusual entry into it, but I'm quite happy that I took that road.
Yes, at the British Science Festival in Newcastle last year, Science Weekly met Professor Des Tobin, Director of the Centre for Skin Sciences at Bradford University, whose lecture on the science behind many of the most popular cosmetic skincare products was one of the hits of the festival. For The Guardian, Natalie Starkey spoke to Des and began by asking him why, as a cell biologist, he had dedicated his working life to the study of human skin.
Very good question. Accident, because while my background was in immunology, basically how the body defends itself against kind of bacteria or other foreign agents, I then drifted towards a PhD in an autoimmune disease called alopecia areata, where the hair can fall out in clumps and eyebrows. And there's some famous cases like Duncan Goodhue, and I think one recent TV presenter lost all her hair that way. And that's basically where the body attacks the hair follicle. So that kind of drew me into the hair follicle. But my initial love was to do a research career on cardiovascular immunology. And I was actually blocked from a particular project in cardiovascular biology because at that time, being Irish, wasn't able to access a funding supply that was only available for British students. That was before the European Union reciprocity issue kicked in. So I had to very quickly, in a week, turn my thoughts away from cardiovascular immunology, which was really gutsy immunology, to a project that was on the hair follicle. And for several years, I was finding it difficult to explain to people that I was doing my PhD on the hair follicle, because they weren't quite sure whether I was actually going to become a hairdresser as a result of it or not. So it was a very unusual entry into it, but I'm quite happy that I took that road.
So the skin is an amazing organ, but there's lots of kind of old wives' tales around hair follicles and skin. Are people more hairy than some people? Do you have any kind of interesting facts about this?
Good question. I think it'll surprise a lot of people to realize that most humans, regardless of whether they look, you know, very hairy, like almost reminding us of our ancestors, the chimpanzee, versus the most alabaster of skins, where you can't see a single hair at all. Actually, both those two individuals have the same number of hairs per unit area. And it's just that you can't see the ones on the alabaster skin. They're tiny and pigment-free versus the others, which are longer and darker. And another kind of interesting thing around hair is, you know, if you pluck a hair, does two grow in this place? Mm-hmm. Totally not true. If you shave your hair really tight as a young adolescent male, are you less likely to go bald? Totally not true. Why does hair grow on your nose and your chin? For women, for example, it's a hormonal thing after menopause where androgen estrogen levels flip over and they have very little estrogen, now a lot of androgen by ratio, and so the hair gets kick-started into growing on their chins and lips, etc. The other area that's quite interesting is that the tip of your nose is actually your body's hairiest site, where the hairs are very densely packed, and that's because it's the part of your body that has grown least since you were a babe in arms. So while your arms and legs and torso have all elongated and lengthened as you grew up, and every follicle therefore was separated by more and more of spacing between it, the tip of your nose is largely the same size as it was when you were a baby. So as a result, the packing is still as dense there. So there's several other weird things about Samson and, you know, cutting his hair off and the power and a lot of ethnicity and religious and cultural stuff invested in the hair as a source of power or spiritual power or even chastity issues around veiling of hair in different cultures. So there's a huge issue around how humans have taken hair into their everyday lives.
And then there's also the issue of sweating, isn't there? Because obviously humans do sweat, some people more than others. But it's an important thing that we have to do, otherwise we'd die of overheating. I mean, how much do humans really sweat? Do some people sweat more than others naturally?
Yeah, there seems to be some variation within the human family for sweating. And of course, it depends on what part of the world you're living in and whether you've been kind of parachuted into a very hot area and you're not used to it. You'll sweat more initially and then eventually kind of join more like the people who are already there, who live there. But as a species, we're probably the sweatiest mammals around. It's very hard to compare different animals, but, you know, for horses and dogs, we see them attempting to sweat, but they sweat inefficiently because they have got this heavy, dense coat of hair that becomes matted and wet and damp, and they can't really let the heat... that's why you see the dog's tongue hanging out, where a lot of the heat has been lost from the tongue. In terms of humans, the top sweater, the top athlete who's running in a hot climate can sweat up to 10 litres a day.
Oh, wow.
So if you can imagine just piling those bottles of litre water in front of you. And even during your sleep at night, you sweat an awful lot.
Yeah.
Into the mattress, and you're not necessarily feeling hot at that particular point. It's just the normal exchange from inside to outside of your bodies.
That's just part of our system. Keeps us going.
An important part of a system that encouraged us to actually evolve. Being efficient sweaters has encouraged humans to evolve more efficiently.
I saw your talk this week about the science of cosmetics, and it's really opened my eyes to, am I spending far too much money on face creams? You know, this is the question. This is part of what your research looks at. So how much should we be spending on face creams? Are they actually doing us any good?
Well, my advice to anyone, including my own family members, if they asked a similar question, would be to try and do a little bit of research behind the individual product that you're using, and more importantly, the manufacturer, the company who's putting their name behind the product, and whether they're actually engaged in active research and development of their technologies to ensure that the claims that they make can be substantiated in a scientific sense. And that may mean that they have to engage with the scientific community via publishing papers, etc.
Okay, but this is, you know, it's a big industry, isn't it? It's worth a lot of money. I think you mentioned $300 billion in 2017, it's estimated to be worth.
Yes.
I mean, this is a huge amount of money. And I think, you know, from my perspective, you know, one as a member of the public who buys these kind of creams, if I'm going to spend an awful lot of money on a cream, you know, and then I think, right, well, can I trust the science they're giving me? You know, can I go to you and you can tell me, yes, this is definitely a cream worth buying? And how do the public know who to trust?
It's very hard to give a very straightforward answer. I mean, there are certain kind of basic components of sun creams and regular kind of cosmetic creams, and that would be around moisturizing benefit, potential effect on some of the aging changes that happen around, for example, loss of collagen in the skin, or around, for example, pigmentation effects that happen with aging. So certain products may segment themselves to target particular areas of need in terms of what is aging skin overall. So there was a period, for example, where fine lines and wrinkles dominated the whole kind of discussion in this area. But now increasingly for some ethnicities, particularly the Asian ethnicities, Japanese, Chinese ethnicities, pigmentation, hyperpigmentation or pigmentation spots are a greater sign that they're getting old than, for example, wrinkles are. So depending on what it is that you're seeking to do, you may not be able to get one cream that does everything, although increasingly attempts are made to kind of pack these creams with multiple technologies, both kind of a filter against the sun, something that may help with remodeling collagen, for example, and something that may affect also age spots. So we really have to look very carefully, because there's such a raft of products out there and a whole raft of claims that go with them, that I would say even if you don't have beyond an A level of biology or GCSE of biology, you do some general checking of the company that's making the product that you want to chase to see if they are engaged in the science of it.
So in terms of the science, I take it that we are not allowed to do animal testing for cosmetic products any longer. Is that correct?
That's correct. The European Union has deemed that there's no acceptable reason to use animals for cosmetic products.
So how do we test these things then? Do we get people put some cream on their arm, put some cream on their face that we haven't tested previously? How does it work in your kind of area?
Well, I mean, it's somewhat of an uncharted territory. You would have thought that they would have had the substitute kind of testing scenario already in place before, for example, the changeover happened. But To some extent, they have, in that more and more in vitro tests, laboratory test tube type environments, are coming on stream and are being improved and validated within the European kind of regulatory framework. Perhaps the most exciting one of those would be the kind of skin in the lab, or the kind of so-called lab skin context, although lab skin is a proprietary name for one such product manufactured by a company called Evocutis. There are other skin equivalents, or what we call organotypic structures. And basically what they are is that you take a piece of human skin, say from a clinic, and you isolate all the different cell types, and then you reconstruct in the lab a multi-layered, three-dimensional structure that kind of comes as close as you possibly can in a lab environment to creating a human skin. Because at the moment, most of this work is done on cells growing flat on the surface, where they don't have that, so it's only two-dimensional. And we know from our own skins it's three-dimensional. So this move toward three-dimensional skin assays has shown the best chance of getting close to the initial toxicity and the toxicological and health and safety aspect of product testing. Thereafter, if it passes that set of hurdles or that set of tests, then you can start to use volunteers and apply it directly onto the surface of their own skin, because you're already pretty sure at that point that it's unlikely to be burning of the skin or cause a rash or whatever. But people are kind of sensitive to certain things in any case. You never will ultimately know until you try it.
And the skin is, I mean, it's a very complex system, isn't it? I mean, from your talk, I didn't know this much about the skin before, but it's an interplay, it's a barrier, you said,
yes,
and it's an interplay between, you know, keeping things out, essentially, and we're trying to put creams on to get things into our skin to improve the quality of our skin. So can you explain a little bit about how those two things work together and why we're trying to get creams into our skin? Do we want to do this?
I mean, there is an apparent paradox. As you mentioned, the skin was designed by nature as principally a barrier. And we see in cases of people with eczema, for example, where they have a defect of that barrier, that it causes a lot of trouble. So while it is a barrier, though, we also know that as we perspire and other kind of activities, that certain materials that we produce inside the body make their way outside on the surface of the skin, predominantly sweat, for example. So we know that it's an open system. While it's a barrier, it's still an open system. So things can get out, like water and salts, etc. There is a possibility for things getting in if they're small enough and if their chemistries are amenable to the current chemistry in the skin at that place. So while creams are used to moisturize the surface of the skin, there are certain things you can do with creams to give them a better chance of getting a little bit deeper into the skin. But there's still a lot of controversy as to how deep anything can go in the skin. Some people say the hair follicle and the sweat gland openings are ports of entry for carrying certain things in the skin. Some people say that if you add an extra kind of a penetration enhancer along with your special ingredient, you might be able to drag what you're looking for into the skin more deeply. But it is only a new area of research. And then you also need to ask, to follow up your second half of your question, do we really want to have lots of things now being dragged into the skin that nature would have perhaps avoided? Well, that's a significant issue in the health and safety side of things. And I think we need to be more careful in assuming that certain ingredients are neutral in the potential health and safety aspects than we perhaps currently are. But we don't yet have enough good science to tell us that, for example, the nanoparticles, the nanoscience revolution could have some health concerns later down the track for us.
And would we know, as a member of the public, if we bought some cream with nanoparticles in it, would we be told, you know, that they were small enough to enter our skin to a deep level? Would is this something we know yet?
Or? I think this whole area is rather unsatisfactory, in my opinion. While there has been a recent agreement, in a sense, as to what is the definition of a nanoparticle in terms of what is the minimum maximum size to be assigned that
so
what's term.
What is the size?
Well, the expression nano usually reflects something being in the nanometer range. And just for your readers and listeners, one nanometer is a thousandth of one micrometer, and one micrometer is a thousandth of a millimeter. And most people have a sense of what a millimeter is. Mm. So they really, really are very, very tiny structures. Now, the type of particle that probably has the best chance of getting into the skin is somewhere around 40 nanometers, 40 to 70 nanometers. But just how deeply into the skin they go is a big issue. And while you may want to get them to go in a little bit, but still be focused on the surface of the skin for direct action, where you think your wrinkles are, your collagen deficit is, you obviously may not want them to go anywhere near the deeper structures in the body, get picked up by the bloodstream and brought into other organs or other tissues. So this is an area that really I think the toxicologists are keen on assessing. Regulatory bodies should definitely be keen on assessing further. But unfortunately, we sometimes play catch up in those areas when already things are already in the marketplace and in the environment. You know.
So, okay, I'm wondering then, if you were to give me some advice for my future, and maybe it's a little bit late now, maybe, I don't know. But what would your recommendations be? Usually it would be like stay out of the sun, put lots of sunblock on, but are there any other things that you might recommend to younger people as well as older people for products we should be looking for?
Well, I mean, in terms of global skin health, to some extent we are what we eat. In a sense, we're encouraged predominantly now when everybody's worried about our relationship with food and obesity and diabetes and all these other issues associated with food, that we have a balanced diet, that we gain enough nutrients, micronutrients through balanced diet, that will then be seen as a signature in our skin as well. We know, for example, that horses and other kind of show dogs are all kind of sold economically on the basis of the quality of their coats and, you know, as a kind of a surrogate or proxy as to their total body health. Similarly for humans, if we see someone who looks, who is poorly, it often looks in their face and in their skin in terms of the colouring of the skin, the healthiness of the skin. So I would say good balanced diet, and obviously it's very boring kind of advice, balanced diet, exercise. If you find that you would like to try and slow the advancing the changes that you see with age that are inevitable, there appears to be good scientific reasons to have some faith in topical application of some ingredients that may be able to intervene with normal things that get sluggish with age. I'm thinking pretty much the whole area of oxidative stress. Mm-hmm. Oxidative stress is pretty much reactive species from oxygen that are less efficiently neutralized in aging skin versus in youthful skin. And there are vitamins and other types of ingredients that people can eat or apply to the skin that will scavenge or neutralize some of these reactive oxygen-derived molecules that could perhaps slow down that
so
kind of aging effect.
What are these, you know, vitamins? Are they easily available?
Yeah, vitamin C, vitamin E. Vitamin A has been known through retinol and other modified versions of vitamin A is important for collagen and for remodeling the skin. So, I mean, there's no real mystery in some of those. I mean, there's some other ingredients that, you know, we've heard of more recently, like lycopene from tomatoes and other types of food sources like that, that people are now trying to kind of packaged together into a kind of delivery capsule in either orally taken or on the skin.
Yeah, so we might just have a pill for the future. We won't need to worry about moisturising and all these creams that we put on our skin. We'll just take a pill with breakfast and we'll be sorted.
We'll be able to ensure that we deliver to the skin what it needs and what it's being depleted of in time.
Okay, so it seems we might not be far away from developing a pill that we can maybe take with our breakfast and we won't have to moisturise in the future. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, I'm not quite sure we'll have the elixir of all of this within a single pill. And actually, there are some products out there already through nutraceuticals or kind of nutrient supplements that are targeted toward the skin and hair and nails and these types of structures on our body. But in terms of being able to have a regimen through diet or whatever that would be protective of the skin in sun or the skin in aging, I think we should be able to do that. It may be slightly different for different people of different ethnicities who need different things in terms of sun protection or whatever. But I think we should be able to apply something or to take something. But I still think there is some kind of buzz that people get in the massaging of their face with cream that they think is kind of enhancing of their preparation for the world, that I think it's very hard to substitute by a pill. So I think a little bit of the of the rubbing and cocooning of the face will go on. Yeah.
Many thanks to Professor Des Tobin there. We'll have links to his work at the University of Bradford on the blog for this edition. That's theguardian.com/science, where of course you'll find the best breaking science news and analysis on the web. Also, a huge thanks to Dr. Natalie Starkey. I strongly recommend checking out Natalie's blog on all things cosmochemistry, space science and geology related. That's at nataliestarkey.com. Again, we'll have links for that on our blog. Well, that's all we have for you this week. The show is produced by me, Jason Phipps. Thanks for listening, and do come back next Monday. Goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.